thing that Cristoforo had never had on his first voyage. What could be communicated by hand signs and pointing and facial expressions wasn't much. The lack of a common language had forced both the Indies and the Europeans to depend on guesswork about what the other side really meant. It made for ludicrous misunderstandings. Any syllable that sounded like Khan sent Cristoforo chasing after Cathay, and at this moment, in Guacanagara's main village, Cristoforo was no doubt asking where more gold could be found. When Guacanagari pointed up the mountain and said Cibao, Cristoforo would hear it as a version of Sipangu. If it really had been Sipangu, Japan, the samurai would have made short work of him and his men. But the most disturbing thing was that in the prior history, it never crossed Cristoforo's mind that he didn't have the right to go straight to any gold mine he might find on Haiti and take possession of it. She remembered what Cristoforo wrote in his log when Guacanagari's people worked long and hard to help him load all his equipment and supplies off the wrecked Santa Maria. They love their neighbor as themselves. He was capable of thinking of them as having exemplary Christian virtues, and then turn right around and assume that he had the right to take from them anything they owned. Gold mines, food, even their freedom and their lives. He was incapable of thinking of them as having rights. After all, they were strangers, dark of skin, unable to speak any recognizable language, and therefore, not people. It was one of the hardest things for novices in Pastwatch to get used to in studying the past, the way that most people and most times were able to speak to people of other nations, treat with them, make promises to them, and then go off and act as if those very people were beasts. What were promises made to beasts? What respect did you owe to property claimed by animals? But Deco had learned, as most did in Pastwatch, that for most of human history, the virtue of empathy was confined to one's kinship group or tribe. People who were not members of the tribe were not people. Instead, they were animals, either dangerous predators, useful prey, or beasts of burden. It was only now and then that a few great prophets declared people of other tribes, even of other languages or races, to be human. Guest and host rights gradually evolved. Even in modern times, when such attractive notions as the fundamental equality and fraternity of humankind were preached in every corner of the world, the idea that the stranger is not a person still remained just under the surface. What am I expecting of Cristoforo, really? Deco wondered. I am asking him to learn a degree of empathy for other races that would not become a serious force in human life until nearly 500 years after his great voyage, and did not prevail worldwide until many bloody wars and famines and plagues after that. I am asking him to rise out of his own time and become something new. And this girl, Chipa, will be his first lesson and his first test. How will he treat her? Will he even listen to her? You are right to be afraid, said Deco in Spanish. The white men are dangerous and treacherous. Their promises mean nothing. If you don't want to go, I won't compel you.
But why else did I learn Spanish? She asked.
So you and I could tell secrets, Deco grinned at her.
I'll go, said Chipa. I want to see them.
Deco nodded, accepting her decision. Chipa was too young and ignorant to understand the real danger that the Spanish would mistreat her. But then, most adults made most of their decisions without a clear understanding of the possible consequences. And Chipa was both clever and good-hearted. The combination would probably serve her well enough. An hour later, Chipa was out in the center of the village, plucking at the woven grass shift that Deco had made for her.
It feels awful, said Chipa in Taino. Why should I wear such a thing?
Because in the white men's country, it is a shameful thing for people to be naked.
Everybody laughed. Why? Are they so ugly?
It's very cold there sometimes, said Deco. But even in the summer, they keep their bodies covered. Their god commanded them to wear things like this.
It's better to sacrifice blood to the gods a few times a year, as the Taino do, said Baiku, than for everybody to have to wear such ugly small houses on their bodies all the time.
They say, said the boy Gowala,
that the white men wear shells like a turtle.
Those shells are strong, and spears don't go through them very easily, said Diko.
The villagers fell silent then, thinking about what this might mean if it ever came to battle.
Why are you sending Chipa to these turtle men? Asked Nukui.
These turtle men are dangerous, but they're also powerful, and some of them have good hearts if we can only teach them how to be human. Chipa will bring the white men here, and when they're ready to learn from me, I'll teach them. And the rest of you will teach them too.
What can we teach to men who can build canoes as big as 100 of ours? Asked Nukui.
They'll teach us too, but not until they're ready.
Nukui still looked skeptical.
Nukui, said Diko, I know what you're thinking.
He waited to hear what she would say.
You don't want me to send Chipa as a gift to Gwakanagari, because then he'll think that this means he rules over Ankuash.
Nukui shrugged. He already thinks that, but why should I make him sure?
Because he'll have to give Chipa to the white men, and once she's with them, she'll serve Ankuash.
She'll serve Seas in the Dark, you mean? It was a man's voice from behind her.
Your name may be Yacha, she said without turning around. But you are not always wise, my cousin. But if I'm not a part of Ankuash, tell me now, and I'll go to another village and let them become the teachers of the white men.
The uproar among the villagers was immediate. A few moments later, Baiku and Pudakam were leading Chipa down the mountain, out of Ankuash, out of Subao, to begin her moment of peril and greatness.
Kamal swam under the hull of the Ninya. He had more than 2 hours' breathing mixture left in the tanks, which was 5 times longer than he would need, if everything went as he had practiced it. It took a little longer than he had expected to chip away the barnacles from a strip of hull near the waterline. You couldn't build up much momentum wielding a chisel underwater. But the job was done soon enough, and then from his belly pouch he drew out the array of shaped incendiaries. He put the heating surface of each one against the hull, and then tripped the automatic self-driving staples that would hold them tight to the wood. When they were all in place, he pulled the cord at the end. At once he could feel the water growing warmer. Despite being shaped to put most of their energy into the wood, they still gave off enough heat into the water that before long it would be boiling. Kamal swam quickly away, back toward his boat. In 5 minutes, the wood inside the hull burst into fierce flames, and still the heat from the incendiaries continued, helping the fire to spread rapidly. The Spanish would have no idea how a fire could have started in the bilge. Long before they could get near the Ninya again, the wood that the incendiaries were attached to would be ash, and the metal shells of the charges would drop to the bottom of the sea. They would give off a faint sonar pulse for several days, allowing Kamal to swim back and retrieve them later. The Spanish would have no idea that the burning of the Ninya was anything but a terrible accident, nor would anyone else who searched the site of the wreck in future centuries. Now everything depended on whether Pinzon remained true to character and brought the Pinter back to Haiti. If he did, Kamal would blow the last caravel to bits. There would be no way to believe it an accident. Columbus would look at the ship and say, "An enemy has done this."
XI. Encounters. Chipa was frightened when Gwakanagari's women brought her forward. Hearing about the bearded white men was different from coming into their presence. They were large men, and they wore the most fearsome clothing. Truly, it was as if each of them wore a house on his shoulders and a roof on his head. The metal of their helmets shone so brightly in the sunlight, and the colors of their banners were like captured parrots. If I could weave a cloth like that, thought Chipa, I would wear their banners and live under a roof made of the metal they put on their heads. Gwakanagari was busy plying her with last-minute instructions and warnings, and she had to pretend to listen. But she already had her instructions from Seas in the Dark, and once she was speaking Spanish with the white man, it would hardly matter what Gwakanagari's plans might be.
"Tell me exactly what they really say," said Gwakanagari,
and don't add a single word to what I say to them beyond what I tell you. Do you understand me, you little snail from the mountains?
Great cacique, I will do all that you say.
Are you sure you can really speak their awful language?
If I can't, you'll soon see it by their faces, Chipa answered.
Then say this to them. The great Guacanagari, cacique of all of Haiti from Cibao to the sea, is proud to have found an interpreter. Found an interpreter? Chipa was not surprised by his attempt to cut seas in the dark out of things, but she was disgusted by it. Nevertheless, she turned to the white man in the most flamboyant costume and started to speak. But she had hardly got a sound from her mouth when Guacanagari pushed her from behind with his foot, throwing her face down on the ground. "Show respect, mountain slug," shouted Guacanagari. "And that's not the chief anyway, stupid girl. It's that man, the white-haired one." She should have known. It wasn't by the volume of his clothing, it was by his age, by the respect his years had earned, that she could recognize the one Season the Dark had called Colon. Lying on the ground, she began again, stammering a bit at first, but still making the Spanish words very clearly.
"My lord, Cristobal Colon, I have come here to interpret for you."
She was answered by silence. She raised her head to see the white men, in wide-eyed astonishment, conferring among themselves. She strained to hear, but they spoke too rapidly. "What are they saying?" asked Guacanagari.
"How can I hear when you're talking?" answered Chipa.
She knew she was being impudent, but if Dico was right, Guacanagari would soon have no power over her. Colon finally stepped forward and spoke to her. "How did you learn Spanish, my child?" he asked. He spoke rapidly, and his accent was different from Seas in the Dark, but this was exactly the question that she had been told to expect.
"I learned this language so that I might learn about Christ."
If they had been flustered before by her command of Spanish, these words brought consternation upon the white men. Again there was a flurry of whispered conversation. "What did you say to him?" demanded Guacanagari.
"He asked me how I came to speak his language, and I told him."
"I told you not to speak of Seas in the Dark," Guacanagari said angrily.
"I didn't," she said. "I spoke of the god they worship."
"I think you're betraying me," said Guacanagari.
"I'm not," said Chipa.
Now when Colon stepped forward, the man in the voluminous clothing was beside him. "This man is Rodrigo Sanchez de Segovia, the royal inspector of the fleet," said Colon. "He would like to ask you a question." The titles meant nothing to Chipa. She had been told to talk to Colon. "How do you know of Christ?" asked Segovia.
"Seas in the Dark told us to look for the coming of a man who would teach us about Christ."
Segovia smiled. "I am that man."
"No, sir," said Chipa. "Colon is the man."
It was easy to read the expressions on the white men's faces. They showed everything they were feeling. Segovia was very angry, but he stepped back, leaving Colon alone in front of the other white men. "Who is this Seas in the Dark?" asked Colon.
"My teacher," Chipa answered. "She sent me as a gift to Guacanagari so he would bring me to you, but he is not my master."
"Seas in the Dark is your mistress?"
"No one is my master but Christ," she said, exactly the statement that Seas in the Dark had told her was the most important she could make. And now, with Colon looking at her, speechless, she said the one sentence that she did not understand, for it was in another language. The language was Genovese, and therefore only Cristoforo understood her as she said words that he had heard before on a beach near Lagos. "I saved you alive so you could carry the cross." He sank to his knees. He said something that sounded like the same strange language. "I don't speak that language, sir," she said.
"What's happening?" demanded Guacanagari.
"The cacique is angry at me," said Chipa. "He will beat me for not saying what he told me to say."
"Never," said Colon. "If you give yourself to Christ, then you are under our protection."
"Sir, Don't provoke Wakanagari for my sake. With both your ships destroyed, you need to keep his friendship.
The girl is right, said Segovia. It won't be the first time she's been beaten.
But it would be the first time, thought Chipa. In the white men's land, were they accustomed to beating children?
You could ask for me as a gift, said Chipa.
Are you a slave, then?
Guacanagari thinks so, said Chipa. But I never was. You won't make me a slave, will you?
Seas in the Dark had told her that it was very important that she say this to Kalon.
You will never be a slave, said Kalon. Tell him that we are very pleased and we thank him for his gift to us.
Chipa had expected him to ask for her, but she saw at once that his way was much better. If he assumed that the gift was already given, Guacanagari could hardly take it back. So she turned to Guacanagari and prostrated herself before him as she had done only yesterday when she first met the cacique of the coastlands.
The great white cacique, Kalon, is very pleased with me. He thanks you for giving him such a useful gift.
Guacanagari showed nothing on his face, but she knew that he was furious. That was all right with her. She didn't like him.
Tell him, said Kalon behind her, that I give him my own hat, which I would never give to any man but a great king.
She translated his words into Taino. Guacanagari's eyes widened. He reached out a hand.
Kalon took the hat from his head, and instead of putting it in the cacique's hand, placed it on Guacanagari's head himself.
Guacanagari smiled. Chipa thought he looked even stupider than the white men did, wearing such a roof on his head, but she could see that the other Tainos around Guacanagari were impressed. It was a good exchange. A powerfully talismanic hat for a troublesome, disobedient mountain girl.
Rise to your feet, girl, said Kalon. He gave her his hand to help her up. His fingers were long and smooth. She had never touched such smooth skin, except on a baby. Did Kalon never do any work?
What is your name?
Chipa, she said. But Seas in the Dark said you would give me a new name when I was baptized.
A new name, said Kalon, and a new life. And then, quietly, so only she could hear,
this woman you call Seas in the Dark, can you lead me to her?
Yes, said Chipa.
Then she added something that perhaps Seas in the Dark didn't mean for her to say.
She told me once that she gave up her family and the man she loved so that she could meet you.
Many people have given up many things, said Kalon. But now would you be willing to interpret for us? I need to have Guacanagari's help in building shelters for my men now that our ships have been burnt, and I need him to send a messenger with a letter for the captain of my third ship, asking him to come here to find us and carry us home. Will you go back to Spain with us?
Seas in the Dark had said nothing about going to Spain. In fact, she had said that the white men would never leave Haiti. But she decided this was not a good time to mention this particular prophecy.
If you go there, she said, I'll go with you.
Pedro de Salcedo was 17 years old. He might be page to the captain general of the fleet, but this never made him feel superior to the common seamen or the ship's boys. No, what made him feel superior was the way that these men and boys lusted after these ugly Indian women. He could hear them talking sometimes, though they had learned not to try to engage him in these conversations. Apparently they couldn't get over the fact that the Indian women went about naked. Not the new one, though. Chipa. She wore clothing, and spoke Spanish. Everyone else was amazed by this, but not Pedro de Salcedo. Clothing and Spanish were to be expected from civilized people. And she was certainly civilized, even if she wasn't yet a Christian. Indeed, she wasn't a Christian at all, as far as Pedro could tell. He had heard all her words to the captain general, of course, but when he was assigned to provide her with safe quarters, he took the opportunity to converse with her. He quickly found that she hadn't the faintest idea who Christ was, and her idea of Christian doctrine was pathetic at best. But then, she did say that this mystical Seas in the Dark had promised that Kalon would teach her about Christ. Seas in the dark. What kind of name was that? And how did it happen that an Indian woman had received a prophecy telling of Colon and Christ? Such a vision must have come from God. But to a woman? And not a Christian woman either. Though come to think of it, God spoke to Moses too, and he was a Jew. That was back when Jews were still the chosen people instead of being the filthy, vile, thieving, Christ-killing scum of the earth. But still, it made you think. Pedro was thinking about a lot of things. Anything to keep him from thinking about Chipa. Because those thoughts were the ones that disturbed him. Sometimes he wondered if he wasn't just as low and vulgar as the seamen and the ship's boys. So hungry for venery that even these Indian women could become attractive to him. But it wasn't that. Not really. He didn't particularly lust after Chipa. He could still see that she was ugly, and for heaven's sake, she didn't even have a woman's shape. She was a child. What kind of pervert would he have to be to lust after her? Yet he also saw something in her voice, her face, that made her beautiful to him. What was it? Her shyness? The obvious pride she felt when she said difficult sentences in Spanish? Her eager questions about his clothing, his weapons, the other members of the expedition? Those sweet little gestures she made when she was embarrassed at making a mistake? The sheer translucence of her face, as if a light shone through from beneath the skin? No. That was impossible. She didn't really glow. It was an illusion. I've been lonely too long. Yet he found that the only part of his duties that he looked forward to these days was tending to Chipa, watching over her, conversing with her. He lingered with her as long as possible, and sometimes neglected his other tasks. Not that he meant to. He simply forgot anything but her when he was with her. And it was useful for him to spend time with her, wasn't it? She was teaching him the Taino language, too. If he learned it well, then there would be two interpreters, not just one. That would be good, wouldn't it? He was also teaching her the alphabet. She seemed to like that most of all, and she was very clever about it. Pedro couldn't think of why she wanted it so much, since there was nothing in a woman's life that made reading necessary. But if it amused her and helped her understand Spanish better, why not? So Pedro was making letters in the dirt, and Chipa was naming them, when Diego Bermudez came looking for him. "The boss wants you," he said. At 12, the boy had no sense of propriety. "And a girl. He's going on an expedition." "Where?" asked Pedro. "To the moon," said Diego. "We've been everywhere else." "He's going to the mountain," said Chipa, "to meet Seas in the Dark." Pedro looked at her in consternation. "How would you know that?" "Because Seas in the Dark said he would come to her." "More of that mystical claptrap. What was Seas in the Dark anyway, a witch?" Pedro could hardly wait to meet her. But he'd have his rosary triple wrapped around his wrist and hold the cross in his hand the whole time. No sense taking chances.
Chipa must have done well, Deco decided, for runners had been coming up the mountain all morning telling of the coming of the white men. The most annoying messages were from Guacanagari, full of half-veiled threats about any attempt by an obscure mountain village like Ancuash daring to interfere with the great cacique's plans. Poor Guacanagari. In the prior version of history, he had also had the illusion that he was in control of relations with the Spanish. The result was that he ended up being a quisling, betraying other Indi leaders until he, too, was destroyed. Not that he was any stupider than others who had fooled themselves into thinking that they'd got the tiger under control just because they're holding on to its tail. It was mid-afternoon when Cristoforo himself came into the clearing, but Deco was not outside to meet him. She listened to the noise from inside her house, waiting.
Nukkui made a great show of greeting the great white cacique, and Cristoforo, for his part, was gracious. Dico listened with pleasure at the confidence in Chipa's voice. She had taken to her role and did it well. Dico had clear memories of Chipa's death and the other history. By then she was in her 20s, and her children were murdered in front of her before she was raped to death. She would never know that horror now. It gave Dico confidence as she waited in her house. The preliminaries ended. Cristoforo was now asking for seas in the dark. Nukkui, of course, warned him that it was a waste of time talking to the black giant, but this only intrigued Cristoforo all the more, as Dico had expected. Soon he was in front of her door, and Chipa ducked inside. "Can he come in?" she asked in Taino. "You're doing well, my niece," said Dico. She and Chipa had spoken only in Spanish for so long that it felt odd to Dico to revert to the local language with her. But it was necessary, for the moment at least, if Cristoforo was not to understand what they said to each other. Chipa smiled at that and ducked her head. "He brought his page with him. He's very tall and fine, and he likes me." "He'd better not like you too well," said Dico. "You're not a woman yet." "But he's a man," said Chipa with a laugh. "Should I let them in?" "Who is with Cristoforo?" "All the big house people," said Chipa. "Segovia, Arana, Gutierrez, Escobedo, even Torres." She giggled again. "Did you know that they brought him along to be an interpreter? He doesn't speak a word of Taino." "He didn't speak Mandarin either, or Japanese, or Cantonese, or Hindi, or Malay, or any of the other languages he would have needed if Cristoforo had actually reached the Far East as he intended. The poor, myopic Europeans had sent Torres because he could read Hebrew and Aramaic, which they considered to be the matrices of all language. "Let the Captain General come in," said Dico, "and you can bring in your page, too. Pedro de Salcedo?" Chipa did not seem surprised that Dico knew the name of her page. "Thank you," she said, and then stepped outside to bring in the guests. Dico could not help feeling nervous. No, why quibble? She was terrified. To finally meet him, the man who had consumed her life, and the scene they would play would be one that had never existed before in any history. She was so used to knowing what he would say before he said it. What would it be like, now that he had the capacity to surprise her? No matter. She had a far greater ability to surprise him, and she used it immediately, speaking to him first in Genovese. "I've waited a long time to meet you, Cristoforo." Even in the darkness inside her house, Dico could see how his face flushed at her lack of respect. Yet he had the good grace not to insist that she call him by his titles. Instead, he concentrated on the real question. "How is it that you speak the language of my family?" She answered in Portuguese. "Would this be the language of your family? This is how your wife spoke before she died, and your older son still thinks in Portuguese. Did you know that? Or have you spoken to him often enough to know what he thinks about anything?" Cristoforo was angry and frightened, just what she was hoping for. "You know things that no one knows." He was not speaking of family details, of course. "Kingdoms will fall at your feet," she said, imitating as much as possible even the intonation of the voice in Cristoforo's vision from the interveners. "And millions whose lives are saved will call you blessed." "We don't need an interpreter, do we?" said Cristoforo. "Shall we let the children go?" said Dico. Cristoforo murmured to Chipa and Pedro. Pedro got up at once and went to the door, but Chipa didn't move. "Chipa is not your servant," Dico pointed out, "but I will ask her to leave." In Taino she said, "I want the Captain General to speak about things that he won't want anyone else to hear. Would you go outside?" Chipa got up at once and headed for the door. Dico noticed with pleasure that Pedro held the flap open for her. The boy was already thinking of her, not just as a human, but as a lady. It was a breakthrough, even if no one was aware of it yet. They were alone. How do you come to know these things? Asked Cristoforo at once. These promises, the kingdoms would fall at my feet, that I know them, said Dico, because I came here by the same power that first gave those words to you.
Let him interpret that how he would. Later, when he understood more, she would remind him that she hadn't lied to him. She pulled a small solar-powered lantern from one of her bags and set it between them. When she switched it on, he shielded his eyes. His fingers also formed a cross. It isn't witchcraft, she said. It's a tool made by my people of another place, where you could never voyage in all your traveling. But like any tool, it will someday wear out, and I won't know how to make another. He was listening, but as his eyes adjusted, he was also looking at her.
You're as dark as a Moor.
I am an African, she said. Not a Moor, but from farther south.
How did you come here, then?
Do you think you're the only voyager? Do you think you're the only one who can be sent to faraway lands to save the souls of the heathen?
He rose to his feet. I can see that after all my struggles, I have only now begun to face opposition. Did God send me to the Indies only to show me a negress with a magic lamp?
This is not India, said Dico, or Cathay, or Sipangu. Those lie far, far to the west. This is another land entirely.
You quote the words spoken to me by God himself, and then you tell me that God was wrong?
If you think back carefully, you will remember that he never said Cathay, or Sipangu, or India, or any other such name, said Dico.
How do you know this? I saw you kneeling on the beach, and heard you take your oath in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Then why didn't I see you? If I could see the Holy Trinity, why were you invisible?
You dream of a great victory for Christianity, said Dico, ignoring his question, because she couldn't think of an answer that would be comprehensible to him. The liberation of Constantinople.
Only as a step along the way to freeing Jerusalem, said Cristoforo.
But I tell you that here, in this place, there are millions of souls who would accept Christianity if only you offer it to them peacefully, lovingly.
How else would I offer it?
How else? Already you have written in your logbooks about how these people could be made to work. Already you talk about enslaving them.
He looked at her piercingly. Who showed you my log?
You are not yet fit to teach these people Christianity, Cristoforo, because you are not yet a Christian.
He reached back his hand to strike at her.
It surprised her, because he was not a violent man.
Oh, will hitting me prove how Christian you are?
Yes, I remember all the stories about how Jesus whipped Mary Magdalene and the beatings he gave to Mary and Martha.
I didn't hit you, he said.
But it was your first desire, wasn't it? She said.
Why? You are the most patient of men. You let those priests badger you and torment you for years, and you never lost your temper with them. Yet with me, you felt free to lash out.
Why is that, Cristoforo?
He looked at her, not answering.
I'll tell you why. Because to you, I'm not a human being. I'm a dog, less than a dog, because you would not beat a dog, would you? Just like the Portuguese, when you see a black woman, you see a slave.
And these brown people, you can teach them the gospel of Christ and baptize them, but that doesn't stop you from wanting to make slaves of them and steal their gold from them.
You can teach a dog to walk on its hind legs, but that doesn't make it a man.
Oh, that's a clever bit of wisdom. That's just the kind of argument that rich men make about men like your father. Oh, he can dress in fine clothing, but he's still a country bumpkin not worth treating with respect.
Cristoforo cried out in rage. How dare you speak of my father that way?
I tell you that as long as you treat these people even worse than the rich men of Genova treated your father, you will never be pleasing to God.
The flap of the door opened wide, and Pedro and Escobedo stuck their heads into the house.
You cried out, my lord, said Escobedo.
I'm leaving, said Cristoforo.
He ducked and walked through the door.
She turned off her lamp and followed him out into the afternoon light. All of Ancoash was gathered around, and the Spaniards all had their hands on their sword hilts. When they saw her, so tall, so black,
They gasped, and some of the swords began to rise out of their sheaths, but Cristoforo waved their weapons back into place. "We're going," he announced. "There's nothing for us here."
"I know where the gold is," cried Dico in Spanish.
As she expected, it brought her the complete attention of all the white men.
"It doesn't come from this island. It comes from farther west. I know where it is. I can take you there. I can show you so much gold that stories of it will be told forever."
It wasn't Cristoforo, but Segovia, the royal inspector, who answered her.
"Then show us, woman. Take us there."
"Take you there? Using what boat?" The Spaniards remained silent. "Even when Pinzon returns, he won't be able to take you back to Spain," she said. They looked at each other in consternation. How did this woman know so much?
"Colón," she said, "do you know when I will show you that gold?"
He was with the other white men now as he turned to face her.
"When is that?"
"When you love Christ more than gold," Dico answered.
"I already do," said Cristoforo.
"I will know when you love Christ more than gold," said Dico. She pointed to the villagers.
"It will be when you look at these and see, not slaves, not servants, not strangers, not enemies, but brothers and sisters, your equals in the eyes of God. But until you learn that humility, Cristobal Colón, you will find nothing but one calamity after another."
"Devil," said Segovia. Most of the Spaniards crossed themselves.
"I do not curse you," she said. "I bless you. Whatever evil comes upon you comes as a punishment from God, because you looked at his children and saw only slaves. Jesus warned you. Whoever harms one of these little ones, it would be better for him to tie a millstone around his neck and throw himself into the sea."
"Even the devil can quote scripture," said Segovia, but his voice didn't sound very confident.
"Remember this, Cristoforo," Dico said. "When all is lost, when your enemies have brought you down to the depths of despair, come to me in humility, and I will help you do the work of God in this place."
"God will help me do the work of God," said Cristoforo. "I need no heathen witch when I have him on my side."
"He will not be on your side until you have asked these people to forgive you for thinking that they were savages."
She turned her back on him and went back into her house. Outside, she could hear the Spaniards shouting at each other for a few moments. Some of them wanted to seize her and put her to death on the spot, but Cristoforo knew better. Angry as he was, he knew that she had seen things that only God and he had known. Besides, the Spanish were outnumbered. Cristoforo was nothing if not prudent. You don't commit to battle until you know that you'll win. That was his philosophy. When they were gone, Dico emerged again from her house. Nukui was livid.
"How dare you make these white men so angry? Now they'll be friends with Guacanagari and never visit us again."
"You don't want them as friends until they learn how to be human," said Dico. "Guacanagari will beg for them to be friends with someone else before this story is played out. But I tell you this, no matter what happens, let it be known that no harm is to come to the one they call Colón, the white-haired one, the cacique. Tell it to every village and clan. If you harm Colón, the curse of Seas in the Dark will come upon you."
Nukkui glowered.
"Don't worry, Nukkui," she said. "I think Colón will be back."
"Maybe I don't want him back," Nukkui retorted. "Maybe I just wish you and he both would go away."
But he knew the rest of the village wouldn't stand for it if she left. So she said nothing until he turned and walked out into the forest. Only then did she return to her house, where she sat on her sleeping mat and trembled. Wasn't this exactly what she had planned? To make Cristoforo angry but plant the seeds of transformation in his mind. Yet, in all her imagining of this encounter, she had never counted on how powerful Cristoforo was in person. She had watched him, had seen the power he had over people, but he had never looked her in the eye until this day, and it left her as disturbed as any of the Europeans who had confronted him. It gave her new respect for those who resisted him, and new understanding of those who bent completely to his will. Not even Tagiri had so much fire burning behind her eyes as this man had. No wonder the interveners chose him as their tool. Come what may, Cristoforo would prevail, given time enough. How had she ever imagined that she could tame this man and bend him to her own plan? No, she said silently. No, I'm not trying to tame him. I'm only trying to show him a better, truer way to fulfill his own dream. When he understands that, those eyes will look at me with kindness, not with fury.
It was a long trip down the mountain, not least because some of the men seemed disposed to take out their anger on the girl, Chipa. Cristoforo was caught up in his own thoughts when he became aware that Pedro was doing his best to shield the girl from the shoving and curses of Arana and Gutierrez. "Leave her alone," Cristoforo said. Pedro looked at him with gratitude, and the girl too. "She's not a slave," said Cristoforo, "nor is she a soldier. She helps us of her own free will so that we'll teach her about Christ."
"She's a heathen witch, just like that other one," retorted Arana.
"You forget yourself," said Cristoforo. Sullenly Arana bowed his head in acknowledgement of Cristoforo's superior rank. "If Pinzon does not return, we'll need the help of the natives to build another ship. Without this girl, we'd be back to trying to talk to them with signs and grunts and gestures."
"Your page is learning their babble," said Arana.
"My page has learned a few dozen words," said Cristoforo.
"If anything happened to the girl," said Arana, "we could always come back up here and take that black whore and make her interpret for us."
Chipa spoke up in fury.
"She would never obey you."
Arana laughed. "Oh, by the time we were through with her, she'd obey, all right." His laugh got darker, uglier. "And it'd be good for her, too, to learn her place in the world."
Cristoforo heard Arana's words, and they made him uncomfortable. A part of him agreed completely with Arana's sentiments, but another part of him couldn't help but remember what Season the Dark had said, until he saw the natives as equals. The thought made him shudder. These savages, his equals? If God meant them to be his equals, he would have let them be born as Christians. Yet there was no denying that Chipa was as smart and good-hearted as any Christian girl. She wanted to be taught the word of Christ and to be baptized. Teach her, baptize her. Put her in a fine gown and she would still be brown-skinned and ugly. Might as well put a monkey in a dress. Season the Dark was denying nature to think it could be otherwise. Obviously, she was the devil's last-ditch effort to stop him, to distract him from his mission, just as the devil had led Pinzon to sail the Pinta away. It was near dark when he returned to the half-completed stockade where the Spanish were encamped. He could hear the sound of laughter and revelry in the camp, and was prepared to be angry about the lack of discipline, until he realized why. There, standing beside a large fire, regaling the gathered seamen with some tale or other, was Martin Alonso Pinzon. He had come back. As Cristoforo strode across the open area between the gate of the stockade and the fire, the men around Pinzon became aware of him and fell silent, watching. Pinzon, too, watched Cristoforo's approach. When he was near enough for them to speak without shouting, Pinzon began his excuses. "Captain General, you can't imagine my dismay when I lost you in the fog coming away from Colba." Such a lie, thought Cristoforo. The Pinta was still clearly visible after the coastal fog dissipated. "But I thought, why not explore while we're separated? We stopped at the island of Babeque, where the Colbanos said we'd find gold, but there wasn't a bit of it there. But east of here, along the coast of this island, there were vast quantities of it. For a little strip of ribbon, they gave me gold pieces the size of two fingers, and sometimes as large as my hand." He held up his large, strong, calloused hand. Cristoforo still did not answer, though now he stood not 5 feet from the captain of the Pinta. It was Segovia who said, "Of course you will give a full accounting of this gold and add it to the common treasury." Pinzon turned red. "What do you accuse me of, Segovia?" he demanded. He might accuse you of treason, thought Cristoforo. Certainly of mutiny. Why did you turn back? Because you couldn't make any better headway against the east wind than I did? Or because you realized that when you returned to Spain without me there would be questions that you couldn't answer? So not only are you disloyal and untrustworthy, but you are also too cowardly even to complete your betrayal. All of this remained unsaid, however. Cristoforo's rage against Pinzón, though it was every bit as justified as his anger toward Seas in the Dark, had nothing to do with the reason God had sent him here. The royal officials might share Cristoforo's contempt for Pinzón, but the seamen all looked at him as if he were Charlemagne or El Cid. If Cristoforo made an enemy of him, he would lose his control over the crew. Segovia and Arana and Gutierrez didn't understand this. They believed that authority came from the king. But Cristoforo knew that authority came from obedience. In this place, among these men, Pinzón commanded much more obedience than the king. So Cristoforo would swallow his anger, so that he could make use of Pinzón in accomplishing God's work. "He accuses you of nothing," said Cristoforo. "How can anyone think of accusing you? The one who is lost is now found. If we had a fatted calf, I'd have it slaughtered now in your honor. In the name of their majesties, I welcome you back, Captain Pinzón." Pinzón was obviously relieved, but he also got a sly look in his eyes. "He thinks he has the upper hand," thought Cristoforo. "He thinks he can get away with anything. But once we're back in Spain, Segovia will support my view of events. We'll see who has the upper hand then." Cristoforo smiled, held out his arms, and embraced the lying bastard.
Hunapu watched as the three Tarascan metalsmiths handled the iron bar he had taught them how to smelt, using the charcoal he had taught them how to make. He watched them test it against bronze blades and arrowheads. He watched them test it against stone. And when they were done, the three of them prostrated themselves on the ground before him. Hunapu waited patiently until their obeisance was done. It was the respect due to a hero from Xibalba, whether they were impressed by iron or not. Then he told them to rise from the ground and stand like men. "The lords of Xibalba have watched you for years. They saw how you worked with bronze. They saw the three of you working with iron, and they argued among themselves. Some of them wanted to destroy you, but some of them said no. The Tarascans are not bloodthirsty like the Mexica or the Tlaxcalans. They will not use this black metal to slaughter thousands of men so that barren fields burn under the sun without anyone to plant maize." "No, no," agreed the Tarascans. "So now I offer you the same covenant I offered to the Zapotecs. You've heard the story a dozen times by now." Yes, they had. "If you vow that you will never again take a human life as sacrifice to any god, and that you will only go to war to defend yourselves or to protect other peace-loving people, then I will teach you even more secrets. I'll teach you how to make this black metal even harder, until it shines like silver. We would do anything to know these secrets. Yes, we take this vow. We will obey the great one Hunapu in all things. I am not here to be your king. You have your own king. I ask only that you keep this covenant, and then let your own king be as a brother to Nayaxhal, the king of the Zapotecs, and let the Tarascans be brothers and sisters to the Zapotecs. They are masters of the great canoes that sail the open sea, and you are masters of the fire that turns stone into metal. You will teach them all your secrets of metalwork, and they will teach you all their secrets of shipbuilding and navigation. Or I will return to Xibalba and tell the lords that you are ungrateful for the gift of knowledge." They listened wide-eyed, promising everything. His words would be relayed to the king soon enough, but when they showed him what iron could do and warned him that one Hunapu knew how to make an even harder metal, he would agree to the alliance. Hunapu's plotting would be complete then. The Mexica and the Tlaxcalans would be surrounded by an enemy with iron weapons and large, fast ships. Huitzilopochtli, you old faker, your days of drinking human blood are numbered. I've done it, thought Hunapu, and ahead of schedule. Even if Kamal and Diko failed, I will have suppressed the practice of human sacrifice, unified the people of Mesoamerica, and given them a high enough technology to be able to resist the Europeans whenever they come. Yet, even as he congratulated himself, Hunapu felt a wave of homesickness sweep over him. Let Diko be alive, he prayed silently. Let her do her work with Columbus, and make of him a bridge between Europe and America, so that it never comes to bloody war.
It was supper time in the Spanish camp. All the officers and men were gathered for the meal, except for the four men on watch around the stockade and the two men who watched the ship. Cristoforo and the other officers ate apart from the others, but all ate the same food, most of which was provided by the Indians. It was not served by Indians, however. The men served themselves, and the ship's boys served the officers. There had been serious difficulties over that, beginning when Chipa refused to translate Pinzon's orders to the Indians. They're not servants, said Chipa. They're friends. In reply, Pinzon had started beating the girl, and when Pedro tried to intervene, Pinzon knocked him down and gave him a solid beating, too. When the Captain General demanded that he apologize, Pinzon gladly agreed to apologize to Pedro. He shouldn't have tried to stop me, but he is your page, and I apologize for punishing him when that should be left to you. The girl, too, Colón had said. To which Pinzon had replied by spitting and saying, the little whore refused to do what she was told. She was insolent. Servants have no business talking to gentlemen that way. When did Pinzon become a gentleman, thought Pedro. But he held his tongue. This was a matter for the Captain General, not for a page. She is not your servant, Colón said. Pinzon laughed insolently. All brown people are servants by nature, he said. If they were servants by nature, said Colón, you wouldn't have to beat them to get them to obey. It's a brave man who beats a little child. They'll no doubt write songs about your courage. That had been enough to silence Pinzon, at least in public. Ever since then, there had been no attempt to get the Indians to give personal service. But Pedro knew that Pinzon had not forgiven or forgotten the scorn in the Captain General's voice, or the humiliation of having been forced to back down. Pedro had even urged Chipa to leave. Leave, she had said. You don't speak Taino well enough yet for me to leave. If something goes wrong, Pedro had told her, Pinzon will kill you. I know he will. Seas in the dark will protect me, she said. Seas in the dark isn't here, said Pedro. Then you'll protect me. Oh, yes. That worked so well this time. Pedro couldn't protect her, and she wouldn't leave. It meant that he lived with constant anxiety, watching how the men watched Chipa, how they whispered behind the Captain General's back, how they gave many signs of their solidarity with Pinzon. There was a bloody mutiny coming. Pedro could see it. It awaited only an occasion. When Pedro tried to talk to the Captain General about it, he refused to listen, saying only that he knew the men favored Pinzon, but they would not rebel against the authority of the crown. If Pedro could only believe that. So this evening Pedro directed the ship's boys in serving the officers. The unfamiliar fruits had grown familiar, and every meal was a feast. All the men were healthier now than at any time before in the voyage. From outward appearances, everything was perfectly pleasant between the Captain General and Pinzon. But, by Pedro's count, the only men that Colón could count on his side in a crisis were himself, Segovia, Arana, Gutierrez, Escobedo, and Torres. In other words, the royal officers and the Captain General's own page. The ship's boys and some of the craftsmen would be on Colón's side in their hearts, but they wouldn't dare to stand against the men. For that matter, the royal officers had no personal loyalty to Colón himself. Their loyalty was simply to the idea of proper order and authority. No. When the trouble came, Colón would find himself almost friendless. As for Chipa, she would be destroyed. I will kill her myself, thought Pedro, before I let Pinzón get his hands on her. I will kill her, and then I will kill myself. Better still, why not kill Pinzón? As long as I'm thinking of murder, why not strike at the one I hate instead of the ones I love? These were Pedro's dark thoughts as he handed another bowl of melon slices to Martín Pinzón. Pinzón winked at him and smiled. He knows what I'm thinking, and he laughs at me, thought Pedro. He knows that I know what he's planning. He also knows that I'm powerless. Suddenly a terrible blast shattered the quiet evening. Almost at once the earth shook under him, and a blast of wind from seaward knocked Pedro down. He fell right across Pinzón, and almost at once the man was hitting and cursing him. Pedro got off him as quickly as possible, and it soon became clear even to Pinzón that it wasn't Pedro's clumsiness that had caused their collision. Most of the men had been bowled over by the blast, and now smoke and ash filled the air. It was thickest toward the water. "The Pinta!" cried Pinzón. At once everyone else took up the cry and ran through the thickening smoke toward the shore. The Pinta wasn't on fire. It simply wasn't there at all. The evening breeze was gradually clearing the smoke when they finally found the two men who were supposed to be on watch. Pinzón was already laying on them with the flat of his sword before Colón could get a couple of men to pull him off. "My ship!" cried Pinzón. "What have you done to my ship?" "If you stop beating them and shouting at them," said Colón, "perhaps we can learn from them what happened." "My ship is gone, and they were supposed to watch it," cried Pinzón, struggling to get free of the men who restrained him. "It was my ship, given me by the king and queen," said Colón. "Will you stand alone like a gentleman, sir?" Pinzón furiously nodded, and the men let go of him. One of the men who had been on watch was Rascón, who was part owner of the Pinta.
"Martín, I'm sorry. What could we do?"
"He made us get into the launch and row for shore. And then he made us get behind that rock.
And then the ship blew up."
"He?" asked Colón, ignoring the fact that Rascón had reported to Pinzón instead of to the captain general.
"The man who did it."
"Where is he now?" asked Colón.
"He can't be far," said Rascón.
"He went off that way," said Gil Pérez, the other watchman. "Señor Pinzón, would you kindly organize a search?" His fury properly focused now, Pinzón immediately divided the men into search parties, not forgetting to leave a good contingent behind to guard the stockade against theft or sabotage. Pedro could not help but see that Pinzón was a good leader, quick of mind and able to make himself understood and obeyed at once. That only made him more dangerous as far as Pedro was concerned. When the men had dispersed, Colón stood on the shore, looking out over the many bits of wood that were bobbing on the waves. "Not even if all the gunpowder on the Pinta exploded all at once," said the captain general. "Not even then could it destroy the ship so completely."
"What could have done it then?" said Pedro.
"God could do it," said the captain general. "Or perhaps the devil. The Indians know nothing about gunpowder. If they find this man who supposedly did it, do you think he'll be a Moor?" So the captain general was remembering the curse of the mountain witch. One calamity after another. What could be worse than this? To lose the last ship. But when they found him, the man wasn't a Moor. Nor was he an Indian. He was white and bearded. A large man, a strong one. His clothing had obviously been bizarre even before the men tore much of it from him. They held him, a garrote around his neck, forcing him to his knees in front of the captain general. "It was all I could do to keep him alive long enough for you to speak to him, sir," said Pinzón. "Why
did you do this? Asked Colón. The man answered in Spanish. Thickly accented, but understandable. When I first heard about your expedition, I vowed that if you succeeded, you would never return to Spain. Why? Demanded the captain general. My name is Kamal, said the man. I'm a Turk. There is no god but Allah, and Mohammed is his prophet. The men muttered in rage. Infidel. Heathen. Devil,